Blog Talk Radio.
Red Romantics to dine with the Twisted Sisters as Twisted Tuesdays presents the short stories of Edgar Allan Poe as your inspiration. We await that tolling bell heartbeat that digs its own grave to unearth that raven's squawk where you offer that funeral dirge now rung.
Welcome to Twisted Tuesdays with the Twisted Sisters, and as always, maybe a Twisted Mister or two. Hello, Pam. Happy Tuesday.
Hello,
before Halloween.
Dean. Happy
Ooh.
Halloween week. Yeah.
Happy
How's it going?
Halloween week. Pretty good,
Absolutely.
Thank you. Pretty good. Yep. Our
time.
Our fifth official Halloween week celebration.
Oh, my goodness.
As long as pretty amazing, isn't it?
It really is.
It's
been five awesome years. Very cool.
Absolutely. It's amazing. We've gone 5 years. We'll be 6 years, I believe, next June.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
It is next June. Because that's when everything kicked off and we all kind of decided to give it a whirl. So I think that's pretty awesome. You know,
oh, absolutely.
It's pretty amazing. Time flies when you're having fun.
That's
flies
for sure.
You know, we've had our
true.
Share of both. Yeah, we've had our share of both. But hello, Laurent, and welcome to the party.
Hey, Laurent.
Well, good evening.
Hey,
how you guys
doing?
Maybe you can help me out of here. Maybe you can help me out here. Normally, when I am listening to the show, I have to strain a little bit to hear clearly, even when it's turned all the way up, but that's all right because I can hear it. Tonight, at my lowest volume setting, I'm getting blasted. Is there a volume control at all? Or?
Not that we have control over.
Or is it louder to you than normal, or is it just me?
It's you. You were talking about this.
Yeah, I don't.
You were
It did be clear. You know, the thing is it did. I will have to agree. It probably was louder than usual because it seemed clearer than usual to me. And usually with my phone, I can barely hear it. But it wasn't like blaring loud in my phone. But I will have to say, maybe the Blog Talk Radio gremlins have been putzing around with volume knobs or something.
Maybe. Either way, all right, I'll live through it.
Well, you used to be able to control the volume over on the listen page, but I don't even know if you can do that now. But you're not there. You're on the phone, so you can't even do that. But you were talking about the radio being extremely loud before the show ever started. So it has to be your settings. It can't be the radio.
I'm on my lowest volume setting. I've never been able to hear so loud. Maybe it's the phone. Okay. No mind. No problem. Never mind.
Well, and back to the Halloween week.
Reality.
Yes, and I'm glad we're doing a show featuring poetry inspired by the short stories of Edgar Allan Poe. We have some great inspiration tonight, a wonderful lineup of poetry.
Absolutely. You have some good stuff
definitely looking forward to.
God, I just said something in the room and I was like, who said that? Because I didn't recognize my being picture. I do a lot of work in pictures. Yes, just one of those things. Crack myself up sometimes. It's like, sometimes I don't even read the names. I look at the picture and I go, I know who it is. So, you know, it's always something. Yeah.
Right?
But
exactly.
No, I started out as a good week, and I think it's going to continue to be a good week. So, it's just going to be interesting. Everybody's got a good lineup. And, what have you, and I think that will be just wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful,
yeah.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And, I have to say I've enjoyed the shows that we have so far, and I'm looking to all the rest of them coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. I think it's... I think that's what's neat, because we're not exactly sure what's going to come to be because of the different topics and different intros and what all we have going on. So fun. I like it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, are we ready to go ahead and get the jack-o'-lantern rolling?
We're actually
going to start with an audio that will not have anything to read along to. It'll be just to listen to. And this audio will be a section of The Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe, read by Intimidus Rex. So, Gene, whenever you're ready, go ahead and play that.
And here we go.
The impetuous fury of the entering gust nearly lifted us from our feet. It was, indeed, a tempestuous yet sternly beautiful night, and one wildly singular in its terror and its beauty. A whirlwind had apparently collected its force in our vicinity, for there were frequent and violent alterations in the direction of the wind, and the exceeding density of the clouds, which hung so low as to press upon the turrets of the house, did not prevent our perceiving the lifelike velocity with which they flew, careering from all points against each other, without passing away into distance. I say that even their exceeding density did not prevent our perceiving this, nor was there any flashing forth of the lightning, but the undersurfaces of the huge masses of agitated vapor, as well as all terrestrial objects immediately around us, were glowing in the unnatural light of a faintly luminous and distinctly visible gaseous exhalation which hung about and enshrouded the mansion. "You must not, you shall not behold this," said I, shudderingly, to Usher, as I led him, with a gentle violence, from the window to a seat. "These appearances which bewilder you are merely electrical phenomena, not uncommon, or maybe that they have their ghastly origin in the rank miasma of the tarn. Let us close this casement. The air is chilling and dangerous to your frame. Here is one of your favorite romances. I will read, and you will listen, and so we will pass away this terrible night together." The antique volume which I had taken up was The Mad Tryst of Sir Launcelot Canning, but I had called it a favorite of Usher's more in sad jest than in earnest, for in truth there is little in its uncouth and unimaginative prolixity which could have had interest for the lofty and spiritual ideality of my friend. It was, however, the only book immediately at hand, and I indulged a vague hope that the excitement which now agitated the hypochondriac might find relief, for the mystery of mental disorders is full of similar anomalies, even in the extremeness of the folly which I should read. Could I have judged, indeed, by the wild, overstrained air of vivacity with which he hearkened, or apparently hearkened, to the words of the tale, I might well have congratulated myself upon the success of my design. I had arrived at that well-known portion of the story where Ethelred, the hero of the tryst, having sought in vain for peaceful admission into the dwelling of the hermit, proceeds to make good an entrance by force. Here, it will be remembered, the words of the narrative thus. And Ethelred, who was by nature of a doughty heart, and who was now mighty withal on account of the powerfulness of the wine which he had drunken, waited no longer to hold parley with the hermit, who, in sooth, was of an obstinate and maliceful turn, but feeling the rain upon his shoulders, and fearing the rise of the tempest, uplifted his mace outright, and with blows made quickly room in the plankings of the door for his gauntleted hand, and now, pulling therewith sturdily, he so cracked and ripped and tore asunder that noise of the dry and hollow sounding wood alarumed and reverberated throughout the forest. At the termination of this sentence I started, and for a moment paused, for it appeared to me, although at once concluded that my excited fancy had deceived me, it appeared to me that, from some very remote portion of the mansion, there came indistinctly to my ears what might have been, in its exact similarity of character, the echo, but a stifled and dull one, certainly, of the very best cracking and ripping sound which Sir Launcelot had so particularly described. It was beyond doubt the coincidence alone which had arrested my attention, for, amid the rattling of the sashes of the casements and the ordinary commingled noises of the still increasing storm, the sound in itself had nothing, surely, which should have interested or disturbed me. I continued the story. But the good champion Ethelred, now entering within the door, was sore enraged and amazed to perceive no signal of the maliceful hermit, but in the stead thereof a dragon of a scaly and prodigious demeanor and of a fiery tongue, which sate in guard before a palace of gold with a floor of silver, and upon the wall there hung a shield of shining brass with this legend enwritten: Who entereth here? A conqueror hath been, who slayeth the dragon, the shield shall win. And Ethelred uplifted his mace, and struck upon the head of the dragon, which fell before him, and gave up his pesty breath, with a shriek so hard and harsh, and withal so piercing, that Ethelred had fain to close his ears with his hands against the dreadful noise of it, the like whereof was never before heard. Here again I paused briefly, and now with a feeling of wild amazement, for there could be no doubt whatever that, in this instance, I did actually hear, although from what direction it proceeded I found it impossible to say, a low and apparently distant, but harsh, protracted, and most unusual screaming or grating sound, the exact counterpart of what my fancy had already conjured up for the dragon's unnatural shriek, as described by the romancer. Oppressed as I certainly was upon the occurrence of the second and most extraordinary coincidence by a thousand conflicting sensations in which wonder and extreme terror were predominant, I still retained sufficient presence of mind to avoid exciting by any observation the sensitive nervousness of my companion. I was by no means certain that he had not noticed the sounds in question, although, assuredly, a strange alteration had, during the last few minutes, taken place in his demeanor. From a position fronting my own, he had gradually brought round his chair, so as to sit with his face to the door of the chamber, and thus I could be partially perceive his features, although I saw that his lips trembled as if he were murmuring inaudibly. His head had dropped upon his breast, yet I knew that he was not asleep from the wide and rigid opening of the eye as I caught a glance of it in profile. The motion of his body, too, was at variance with this idea, for he rocked from side to side with a gentle yet constant and uniform sway. Having rapidly taken notice of this, I resumed the narrative of Sir Launcelot, which thus proceeded. And now the champion, having escaped from the terrible fury of the dragon, bethinking himself of the brazen shield and of breaking up of the enchantment which was upon it, removed the carcass out of the way before him and approached valorously over the silver pavement of the castle to where the shield was upon the wall, which in sooth tarried not for his full coming, but fell down at his feet upon the silver floor with a mighty great and terrible ringing sound. No sooner had these syllables passed my lips than, as if a shield of brass had indeed at that moment fallen heavily upon a floor of silver, became aware of a distinct, hollow, metallic, and clangorous, yet apparently muffled reverberation. Completely unnerved, I leaped to my feet, but the measured rocking movement of Usher was undisturbed. I rushed to the chair in which he sat. His eyes were bent fixedly before him, and throughout his whole countenance there reigned a stony rigidity. But, as I placed my hand upon his shoulder, there came a strong shudder over his person. A sickly smile quivered about his lips, and I saw that he spoke in a low, hurried, and gibbering murmur, as if unconscious of my presence. Bending closely over him, I at length drank in the hideous import of his words. "Not hear it? Yes, I hear it, and have heard it. Long, long, long. Many minutes, many hours, many days have I heard it, yet I dared not. Oh, pity me, miserable wretch that I am. I dared not speak. We have put her living in the tomb. Said I not that my senses were acute? I now tell you that I heard her first feeble movements in the hollow coffin. I heard them many, many days ago, yet I dared not speak. And now, tonight, Ethelred, ha, ha, the breaking of the hermit's door, and the death cry of the dragon, and the clangor of the shield. Say, rather, the rending of her coffin, and the grating of iron hinges of her prison, and her struggles within the coppered archway of the vault. Oh, whither shall I fly? Will she not be here anon? Is she not hurrying to upbraid me for my haste? Have I not heard her footstep on the stair? Do I not distinguish that heavy and horrible beating of her heart? Madman! Here he sprang furiously to his feet and shrieked out his syllables as if in the effort he were giving up his soul. Madman! I tell you that she now stands without the door. As if in the superhuman energy of his utterance there had been found the potency of a spell, the huge antique panels to which the speaker pointed threw slowly back upon the instant ponderous and ebony jaws. It was the work of the rushing gust, but then without those doors there did stand the lofty and enshrouded figure of the Lady Madeline Usher. There was blood upon her white robes, and the evidence of some bitter struggle upon every portion of her emaciated frame. For a moment she remained trembling and reeling to and fro upon the threshold, then, with a low moaning cry, fell heavily inward upon the person of her brother, and in her violent and now final death agonies, bore him to the floor a corpse and a victim to the terrors he had anticipated. From that chamber and from that mansion I fled aghast. The storm was still abroad in all its wrath as I found myself crossing the old causeway. Suddenly there shot along the path a wild light, and I turned to see whence a gleam so unusual could have issued, for the vast house and its shadows were alone behind me. The radiance was that of the full, setting, and blood-red moon, which now shone vividly through that once barely discernible fissure of which I have before spoken, as extending from the roof of that building in a zigzag direction to the base. While I gazed, this fissure rapidly widened. There came a fierce breath of the whirlwind. The entire orb of the satellite burst at once upon my sight. My brain reeled as I saw the mighty walls rushing asunder. There was a long, tumultuous shouting sound like the voice of a thousand waters. And the deep and dank tarn at my feet closed sullenly and silently over the fragments of the house of Usher.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. A brilliant reading there by Intimidus Rex. I have to say I'm really thankful to Rex for recording that. And just, wow. You know, when I chose the section I did of The Fall of the House of Usher, I didn't realize it was going to be a full 12 minutes, although in my defense, I did tell him he could cut it down if he wanted to, but, you know, I'm really so thankful that he didn't cut it down, and, you know, the reading was just spot on and beautifully dramatic. Before we continue with comments, I would like to welcome Dexter to the show. So welcome, Dexter. Glad you could join us.
Glad I could be here. Man, that was a scary reading. Rex really got into that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, yes.
Sorry. Just so you know, I picked up Thomas B., and I picked up Dexter, and I picked up Rex.
Ooh.
So just so you know,
cool. Thank you, Jean. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Sorry, I forgot to ask. Mm-hmm. All right, well, then also I need to say hello to Tom and hello to Rex. Glad you could both be here.
How y'all doing?
Doing awesome. How are you?
Very well.
I'm great.
But, oh, my goodness, like I was saying, the fall of the House of Usher, one of my all-time favorite Poe stories, and I truly appreciate, Rex, the professionalism and the heart and enthusiasm that you put into that read. So it was just absolutely beautiful. I will say in all honesty that when it comes to Edgar Allan Poe, I am actually more of a fan of his short stories, to me, than his poetry. Not that I'm dismissing his poetry as extremely gifted and wonderful, but he was such a pioneer in so many fields, including the detective story. He was the inventor of the detective story. But let's go ahead and get people's thoughts. Now, Lawrence, did you have any thoughts on the reading or on, Edgar Allan Poe or, you know, anything that, applies to the topic for the night?
Well, it was a magnificent read. It was about as good as you're going to get. As far as the House of Usher, it's a great story. What's not to enjoy?
Absolutely. I have to agree. And how about you, Tom? Any thoughts on the performance or Edgar Allan Poe and his short stories?
Well, I grew up reading Edgar Allan Poe and his short stories and delighted in them. And I love Rex's voice. You'll not hear me criticize him in any way. Like I said, he'd make a great DJ.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad to hear you wouldn't criticize Rex, because if you did, I'd have to turn you into a toad. And I don't think any of us would want that.
I've been there and back again.
Yeah, but if you did, you'd be forced to kiss
him. I promise you.
And Dexter, your thoughts?
Yeah, that was a fantastic read and a hell of a way to kick off the show. So well done, Rex.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Yes, and now, Rex, of course, I know you're far too humble to brag about your own reading, but I do have to say, the way you just knew to, you had perfect pause, pitch, and punch, and the way your voice got more frantic towards the end, it just was spot on. But do you have any comments you'd like to make about Edgar Allan Poe, about the fall of the House of Usher, or, you know, about his writing in general?
Well, I was listening to that, and I heard the bloody cat in the background. Didn't know that to begin with.
I heard that, too. She wanted to be part of the performance.
I thought I had it right, and the damn cat screaming in the background. I said, Jesus, what the hell? It took me a few turns on that because I got halfway through it once, muffed it, and then two-thirds of the way through it another time and muffed that. And said, oh, God. And finally kind of cracked down and got the whole thing done finally.
Well, I truly, truly appreciate the work that you put into that. I know that's something I'll be listening to more than once. And you know what? Definitely don't change it with the cat in the background, because I think it's awesome that she was in there.
I didn't know she was there, even with the my first hearing it. So.
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was great. And Jean, your thoughts?
Oh, I thought it was a fabulous read. It was long, so I got to tell you, my attention span kind of slips off and comes back. But I really thought it was very well done. And it was a great piece for tonight, you know. Definitely was a great choice for the Poe night, you know. I mean, because it's not something we hear all the time, and, we're so used to hearing, like, the Telltale Heart or so many of his more commonly read pieces. So this was a nice change, and I like that very much. So, good one. Great job, Rex. Great job. I don't think I had
Thank
the perseverance
you,
for all. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have to agree. Great comments, everybody. All right. And
well,
I'm going to go ahead.
For any women who wanted to spend 12 minutes in the dark with Rex, they just did it.
I know, right? What do they call that? 12 minutes in heaven?
Oh, damn.
And a man with a beating.
Check out the pic Dex just put on the page.
Oh,
in
my
the chat.
Goodness. Awesome. That is truly awesome. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and continue it on for the offerings for the night. And I'm going to go ahead and put your poem up, Lawrence. So go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
Okay, I wasn't sure what prompt to choose, but I chose 15A, which was upon a gloomy and tempestuous night of early autumn. And this is called Fading to Black. Disconsolate midnight beeps at my wakefulness, staring high at the clock blocks its rhythm to my pulse, a maddening symphony in cold monotone reverberating beyond my patience. Exasperation consumes me, bloodying my knuckles as I lash out at the damned mechanical device that tortures my hours, tolling my defeat at the hands of implacable, convincingly destroyed. Abrupt silence elevates me, rising suddenly, drying off covers gone sticky and hot. I stalk the surcease of hidden sleep with passion of any needful hunter. Mirror captures the reflection of this wild-eyed, disheveled supplicant to Morpheus. Pausing, I stare at myself, gone, unfamiliar, gaunt stranger in night clothes. My bedside candle flickers to an invisible breeze, dancing shadows dimming as yellow plane doctor is winking out air. It suddenly chill as a loud and resumed freezing a moment in the darkness. Blood can run cold, a sensation heretofore unfelt in my lexicon of experience. Mad fury overcomes me, fighting the fear that grows in my bowels, spurring me to blind motion, steps taken left and right, flailing impotently. Sound becomes a booming, consuming assault on the senses. Lurching forward, the world turns red. Sharp pieces of broken glass and metal pierce my feet. Box guards exacting punishment, causing me to fall to my knees. A roiling tide of pain washing away disbelief, even as the disembodied time teller kicks me insane. Pain and fear governs, driving me upright. The steel beat of gear-driven time echoing loudly, dizzyingly, as I stumble unsteadily towards bed, mistaking the direction, tripping again, falling headfirst through window glass. The stone's flight is brief flight indeed, and the earth is no soft pillow on which I lay my head, but a bleeding ground that sucks at me thirstily, keeping awful time, the syncopation which fades slowly black, silent at last, white as the grave. End poem.
Bravo, Lawrence. Oh, my goodness, a wonderful read. I'm so glad that you were inspired. And let's go ahead and get you some comments. Let's start with Tom. Your thoughts.
I unmuted. This is just utterly delightful in a scary sort of way, of course. The idea of a clock having a purpose and becoming a human being who has to drive you thoroughly insane is delightful, a wonderful idea, especially since I love the snooze control on my iPhone because that's what I keep hitting and while I fight getting up. I love some of these things, the steps taken left, then right, flailing impotently, and the, what was it, was an earlier one, mirror captures the reflection of this wild-eyed, disheveled, supplicant to Morpheus, pausing, I stare at myself, gaunt, unfamiliar, gaunt, stranger in night clothes. I love stuff like that. You have such a rich way of putting words together and setting up these visions in all your work, but really beautifully in this one, that it has a magnificent plausibility while at the same time just reeks of horror. And really nicely done.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Wonderful observation. And Dexter, your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought just stylistically and just if I felt like you just really channeled the prompt very well, but there was just incredible wording throughout this. My favorite stanza was the my bedside candle flickers to an invisible breeze, dancing shadows dimming as yellow flame gutters winked out. Air suddenly chill as a loud ticking resumes, freezing the moment in darkness. Just an incredible stanza, but I just thought that you really captured the style and the feel for what the night holds, I guess. So very well done.
Thank you, Dexter.
Absolutely. And Rex, your thoughts?
The title is apt, and the verbiage used hits on that 19th century thought, which Poe would have used, words like wakefulness, symphony, bloodying, mechanical device, because the mechanical devices were all the new rage, that coming of age in in movement with the mechanics that do the things for you, which you used to have to do yourself. And a word like surcease, which is a nice touch from the Raven. And again, stuff against the Morpheus. And you roll through this nice scenery of darkness, of knocking the cloth off the table just so it shatters because you can't stand the ticking, because it comes across as the telltale heart is that note through the sound that the clock's ticking away and your mind ruminating over it again and again because you're so tired and worn in the moment that you can't stand any sound that bothers and tickles your mind into a frenzy. I, too, was drawn on those the candle flickers, but I thought you had one that was even better, the dancing shadows dimming as yellow flame gutters. Another nice touch to how a candle walks itself down, but also a word that nobody uses anymore to discuss the thought of a flame extinguishing itself. And then you hit on blood can run cold, a sensation heretofore unfelt in my lexicon of experience. Another great line that walks again on that thought of Poe, as well as grows in my bowels, spurring me to blind motion. Now, the back end of the title comes in at the end, where you've already walked over and bloodied your feet, you cried out in pain, you cursed the damn clock, even though you broke it to begin with, that doesn't matter. And now the candle is out, you start something else, which pitches you headlong out the window. And that last stanza, and shall lead to black sign of the last quiet as the grave, is that nice note to release death at last, or maybe not the prose death at last, but sleep, that final sleep, the big sleep. But you hit that last stanza with earth is no soft pillow, but a bleeding ground that sucks at me thirstily, keeping awful time with a single patient which fades. And there's that note fading to black.
Thank you, my friend.
You're welcome.
Wonderful observations there, Rex. I have to say, I really like this, right? And I think you very much captured the tone and vibe. You can tell you are inspired by Poe, and yet you have a voice that's just wonderfully, uniquely your own. You have that kind of the element of a psychological horror that often is in his pieces. I really like your use of the imagery, such as the mirror captures a reflection of this wild-eyed, disheveled supplicant to Morpheus. You see the whole idea of someone addicted to morphine. At least, you know, that's the idea that I got from it. And I really like Pain and Fear Governs driving me upright, the steel beat of gear-driven time echoing loudly, dizzingly. You make time itself a horrific beast. Just an absolutely wonderful write and very well done.
Thank you, Pam.
And Jean, your thoughts.
Thoughts? You want me to have thoughts now? Nobody told me that. That cost extra. Okay. I thought it was an excellent piece, Laurent. I thought it was well done and a wonderful reflection of what I would expect to see from a work inspired by Poe. I think you hit all the right notes. Great language throughout, and I really enjoyed it very much. So, well done.
Very well done. Thank
you. Welcome. I think we have another call. Pam, we have another caller.
We have another caller. Oh, my goodness, how lucky are we tonight?
We are very lucky. Hello, Eric.
It's a
30. Who's calling, please?
Hi, this is Dimitri.
Hi, Dimitri. How are you?
Welcome. Glad you could join
great.
Us.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you join us.
I was a little slow
Absolutely.
On the draw. I didn't get the poem to you guys before showtime, so I couldn't do the normal prep work for it.
Gotcha.
Oh, no
gotcha.
Problem. No problem. Did you put the poem on the board?
I did not. No. I can do that right now if you'd like.
Sure. Go ahead
As
and
always.
Do that. Thank you very much. All right. And moving on, I have up your poem, Tom. Go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
Okay. This one is from the I thought I put the problem. Yeah, beneath the pressure of torments such as these, the fearful remnants of good within me succumbed. The cat is dead. The clouds belly up to the earth. My shoes, moist with the fog, begin to imitate that cat. Lamp lights shimmer. Slit-eyed ghosts watching me like prey as I sway along the byway and hope. I remember, oh, my body remembers, where home is hidden. The cat, like a rat, so into my life as I cared about, as if I cared about its purge. It should have scurried away instead of trying to lick the nipple of my favorite swill, as if to share with something I was capable of doing. It's better dead. No need to feed or worry about its prey. Now I need to put its memory to rest so I can find my own bed. The owl screeches by the barn. I have wandered too far on this road to the farm. I know the road is nearby. If only this fog would abate, then I could seal my fate and rest to wake in morrow's light. There must be snakes about. I heard one hiss. Oh, I must not let it shake my fright, for I might injure myself in some drama best ignored. If I could only be sure where I should turn. I will learn, lean against this post. It is a good host while I warm my tongue with this fine gift of distilled rye. That cat, I can't take my actions back. I am sure in a better life with a good wife, I would not need all this drink for me. Now I wish that me mewling would cease, and I could find some greater peace. Another sip, and the moon's advice, I am a fine man, and oh, so nice. Those lights and cloudy stars, they're far too far, but the wind is close, and I can feel how cats are about and watching me. I am not a rat, that's a fact. Only a man who needs his brew. It's not my fault. A cat I slew. Now, I know I live quite near. Fog, please lift so I can see quite clear. I hear the water slap, and so home is close. I will take a few more steps. I am not lost. Oh, that screeching sound gave me a fright. I felt the cat had returned to life. I mustn't spill my drink. I think I live just to the right. Wait, my feet are not touching ground. I have fallen off the pier. Oh, help, help, for I will drown. The cat was heard as the drunk made his last gurgling sounds, a gentle mew and a paw licked clean, a howl at the moon, and then last seen beneath the pub sign by the village green. End poem, or should I say scream?
I was going to say that was quite a performance. Bravo. Well, Rex, I know now who we need to keep your cat away from. And Dimitri, since you're the new victim in the crypt, let's get a comment from you first.
I was a little distracted because I was posting my my work and I was reviewing it so I'd be ready to read. But I enjoyed the lyricism, right? It had a great rhythm to it, and what I want to call it, the alliteration, the tone of it on the ears was very pleasant.
Absolutely. Well said there. And Laurent, your thoughts.
Are you on mute, Laurent? Oh, yes, I am. I am sorry about that. I'm glad to be around when Tom decides to unleash his pen. Initially, the poem reminded me a little bit of Sandberg's poem, The Fog Comes on Little Cat Peak. It's just looking over harbor and city and silence lunches and then moves on. I mean, you didn't take any part of that. But when you put a cat together with fog, that's the thing that jumps into my mind. The act of slaying the cat was never actually mentioned. One simply had to assume it from the title and from the third stanza, it's better dead, no need to feed or worry about its prey. Now, the stanza following, the owl screeches by the barn. I've wandered too far in this road to the farm. I know the road is nearby. If only this fog would abate, then I could seal my fate and rest the wake in tomorrow's light. It's an example of beautiful writing, and it's all period writing as well. It doesn't smack of the modern. It doesn't necessarily smack of anything in the 18th century, but certainly the 19th century. As Rex said about mine, there are many little things that you can find that one might not ordinarily say in modern speech. The ending is quite nice as well. To drown and then to find out that the cat had actually survived and was, putting his paw under the pub sign of the village green is a fine ending. It's extremely atmospheric, and I appreciate the read and the write. Good job, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Great comment, Laurent. And Rex, your thoughts?
All right. Opening stanza was a great lead-in. The clouds belly up to the earth. My shoes, moist with the fog, begin to imitate that cat. Lamplight shimmer, slug-eyed ghosts watching me like prey as I sway along the byway and hope I remember, or my body remembers, where home is hidden. That's a nice intro. It gives a full view of what's going on. And you already know the guy's got a half a bag on, so to speak. And the thought with my shoes moist with the fog begin to imitate that cat gives rise to what a cat does when its paws get wet. Picks one up, shakes it off, and finds a drier spot for that foot to be laid on. And that walks itself nicely. Then you get the second stanza, and you're ruminating on the cat, hitting on it stole into your life. You don't care about, but that's kind of a backwards offering of, because you're drinking, that might be the thought that you're hitting on the notion of he might not have been such a bad guy, and you're celebrating his passing, so to speak. And again, what Laurent said, you allude to the cat being dead, but you did not say how it died or whether it died by your hand. So that was a nice, clever phrase and turn right there. And then you walk into the owls and the snakes. I thought the snake was good. That gives an inference right back to the cat itself, because cats hiss, and you don't really find a snake out on a wet evening like this. So you've got that little haunting glow coming back in with there must be snakes about, I heard one hiss. And it gives that notion to there is something else lurking in the darkness. And then again, that cat, I can't take my actions back. I am sure in a better life with a good wife, I would not need all this drink for me. Now I wish that mewing would cease and I could find some greater peace. That is that notion. It's on the thoughts of the telltale heart. The mewing comes into the equation, and you're taking more drinks and trying to find your way home, and you get a little lost in the near exactitude of where and when you are at the moment. And in that, you take that dreadful step, which many have done along the banks of the Thames, and found themselves bobbing in the water without a way of actually getting out once more. And that is where they find you the next morning. And then you finish out with the cat, which is a nice touch. You're making your last gurgling sounds, and there's that gentle mew and a poor McQueen while he sits beneath the pub sign by the village green. I thought that was a nice, great ending. It gives a notion to the black cat sitting for its next victim to come out the door.
Yes.
Well done, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you much.
Absolutely. Well said there, Rex. And Dexter, you're off.
Yeah, I thought this was very well done. You know, I thought just the concept of it almost, you know, just brings you back to a certain timing in writing and in horror itself. You know, things that in today's world we almost wouldn't be you know, it's stylistic or it's well done to the point because in today's, you know, day and age it wouldn't be considered horror or very scary or something. Almost like the monkey's paw or something from like along those times, you know. Yeah, the black, don't cross the black cat, you know. Nowadays people be like, oh, big effing deal, but it was perfectly done for when trying to match that tone or and that style. And so it was very well done, and I really enjoyed the ending.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you,
buddy. And I have to agree, the darkness back then was, oftentimes people go for shock value nowadays, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with shock value, but I like this use of subtle emotional and psychological darkness. And I really like your attention to details, how you really got into the mind of a drunk, and especially, and I know Rex brought up this stanza, but the one that started with that cat, I can't take my actions back. First of all, there was a wonderful flow to that stanza, and second of all, it really gets us into the mind of someone who makes excuses for their actions. And I like this all the way through, but I particularly liked the build-up in the final four stanzas and how the last stanza leaves us with the cat. Excellent dark right, Tom, and very well done.
Oh, thank you.
And Jean, your thoughts?
Well, Tom, I got to say, I really like this piece. Boy, it just rang in my ear like a telltale heart. You know, in the telltale heart, it was more a matter of madness, whereas this was a matter of getting drunk and dealing with what happened. And I think it was just really a nice take on it. And, yeah, I really think you did a great job. I really do. That's all I kept hearing all the way through reading. I'm going, God, this doesn't, like, give me that sense of the telltale heart and that anticipation. And it grew, you know, that anticipation grew as you kept reading until you got to the end. And I like that very much. So nice work.
Great comments, everybody. All right, up next we have Oh, did somebody say something?
It wasn't I, it was quiet.
All right. Up next we have Psychosis of a Murderer by Sapphire Rose, and we have a SoundCloud for that, so whenever you're ready, Jean.
Okie dokie. Here we go.
Psychosis of a Murderer by Sapphire Rose. Standing stone-faced, stagnant amid my tortured and twisted surroundings, with a profusion of shutter flashes shocking my nervous system, sadistic thoughts pummel me in every direction, soul-drenching cold encapsulates rationality of mind, with a predatory need to satiate the hollow silence of twisted tapestry. I sink deeper into my chamber of secrets, looking beyond the black waves of weakness. I hide like a recluse, but openly and defiant, with red web seams in the whites of my eyes, trembling limbs unveiling lies hidden in plain sight. my once cherished solitude shattered by the nagging paranoia of my crime. Reflecting, I was back standing fixated on the landscape below, under a Cimmerian sky, inflicting mental slaps rivaling the greatest monsters in history. Rumination beckons me forward, voices whispering for me to step off the edge of this nightmare and escape my fated imprisonment. Corroded perceptions are overtly forsaken, screaming back at the voices, the reality of my crime burning in the ears of those at my back. The rasping actuality burns like a candle tainted in poison, a destined act of revenge on a biblical scale. Or is it? It is always easier to edit what has been written than to write what has not been started. However, man is a creature of habit, and I am a master of my own undoing. End poem.
Amazing read there, Sapphire. I say she's just got a beautiful reading voice, and I really appreciate the SoundCloud. Just a reminder to everyone, if you're not able to call in, then a recording is the next best thing, because then we get to hear your poetry in your voice. And let's go ahead and start with your thoughts, Dexter.
Yeah, this was an incredible write and an amazing read. You know, it just captures you right from, you know, from the atmosphere of it, you know, standing stone-faced, stagnant amid my tortured and twisted surroundings. You know, it just puts you right into this position of just, you know, that's just maddening. Where is it here? Corroding concepts are overly forsaken, screaming back at the voices, the reality of my crime. You know, this is just a person I would think that it's in a prison that's considering hanging themselves or something along those lines because they're just going crazy. And just the wording and the language of throughout this entire piece is just epic. I really enjoyed this write.
Absolutely. Well said there. I have to agree. It definitely is epic. And Tom, your thoughts?
Well, this is really a nice study in the way one's conscience or one's sense of guilt can eat away like mold or rot and slowly destroy one's whole sense of value and worth and reason to live. And she does it so nice and slowly, from sadistic thoughts pummel me in every direction, soul drenching cold encapsulate rationality of mind. And you can hear the conscience beginning to work its way in and telling what a horrible and bad person is. Trembling limbs, unveiling lies, hidden in plain sight, my once cherished solitude shattered by the nagging paranoia of my crime. He knows he was wrong. He knows it's only a matter of time before he must admit to all what he has done, or to take his own life to satisfy this sense of balance. And see, I love the choice of words. I was back fixated, or corroded perceptions are overly forsaken. The rasping actuality burns like a candle tainted in poison. That's a great line. The whole thing just works really beautifully to show how much a person is their own destructive force, whether it's outwardly by murdering someone or it's inwardly by destroying one's sense of self and value. Really beautifully done.
Absolutely. Well said there, Tom. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Pretty amazing piece to get behind the mind of a murderer. And not just any murderer, I think. someone of a murderer of note is such a thing as possible, or a sadistic ruler of a small country, perhaps, that first stands a standing stone-faced, stagnant amid my tortured and twisted surroundings with a profusion of shutter flashes shocking my nervous system. If you go back in time, you needed that shutter flash in order to illuminate what you're taking a picture of, if the lighting wasn't perfect, or even if it was. And who's going to be taking a bunch of pictures of an individual who may have killed somebody? More likely it was something utterly shocking, something fantastic, something larger than life, perhaps. Because a little further on, when he says, where is it? I was back, standing, fixated on the landscape below under a Cimmerian sky, inflicting mental slaps, rivaling the greatest monsters in history, leads me to believe that he may have done something that was a little bit larger than a single murder, perhaps a mass murder. I don't know. Last stanza of our quote, which kind of reinforces that, at least for me, corroded perceptions are overtly forsaken, screaming back at the voices, the reality of my crime, burning in the ears of those at my back. Then it goes on to mention a destined act of revenge on a biblical scale. So I'm led to believe that behind the mind of this murderer is not just any murderer, but somebody who really did something loathsome. And the language, I don't know how much that is. Really, really well done.
Absolutely. Well said there. And Dimitri, your thoughts? Are you on mute, Dimitri?
He dropped him. I assume he didn't
have
dropped.
Okay. Oh, all right. No problem. Well, and then we'll go with, of course, Rex. Your thoughts?
There's a tour de force note of being trapped in one's own private oubliette, the mind, where the escape is nonplussed because you cannot escape your own brain and the twisted thoughts that roil within that edifice itself. I like the that first stanza, the third line down, with a profusion of shutter flashes shocking my nervous system. That hits that notation of the imagery that rolls through. And then again, sadistic thoughts pummel me in every direction, the notation to that which one has done and that, again, which one can sink into. There's a sort of, as one stares into the abyss, you should be well aware that abyss stares into you. But I get down to the last five lines, and they tell me something different. The actuality is this is someone, a writer, a screenplay artist or whatever, they're getting into the node of the character. And in order to do that, you've got to think on their level, royal in the ugliness, the raw homicidal mania that works within it. She hits on the thought of the rasping actuality burns like a candle tainted in poison, a destined act of revenge on a biblical scale. Or is it? It's always easier to edit what has been written than to write what has not been started. However, man is a creature of habit, and I am a master of my own undoing. It kind of hits on the note of, if I do not put that which I delve too deeply into that which I'm getting into, and there I create my own mania, my own madness, and that again puts me on the same plane as an actual murderer. I'm a master of my own psychosis because I dig too deeply into that which comes from others on a painful scale.
Absolutely. Great comment there, Rex. As always, spot on observations. I have to say, I really, really enjoy and appreciate the darkness in this rite. To me, you know, again, the absolute, it's wonderful horror. And sorry, I'm trying to find it. I mean, I know it was wonderful. I just have to get back to it. Sorry. There it is. I like when I'm looking, reading, I like to be looking at something when I'm commenting on it. I really like how she put the word reflecting separately. It gave that kind of pause that was needed. I like looking beyond the black waves of weakness. I hide like a recluse, but openly and defiant, with red webs seen within the whites of my eyes. There's such a sense of madness of somebody who has been imprisoned for and away from the sunlight. And the rasping actuality burns like a candle tainted and poisoned, a destined act of revenge on a biblical scale. Or is it? I like that she has that question there. Or is it? Because it then makes you wonder, you know, what exactly is going on and how guilty or innocent is this man or this person. So absolutely just an amazing dark right and very well done. And all right, great comments, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and bring us on to the next right. And up next, we have Time to Stop and Think by Mark Sheen. And Dexter, would you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. Okay, this is Time to Stop and Think by Mark Green. Coiled ghosts swirl in the wind. I'm sure I can hear them laughing. Look at that poor mortal, kicking the pine cones, spaghetti hair all knotted. I look to the blurred sky, crying soft white confetti. Snowflakes sink into my face. Strangely, I feel the cold but happy. I feel cold but happy. Could there really be such an illusion? Flickers of green grass flutter, peering above the crushed sheet. A robin pecks at the seed head. His little claw feet penetrate like hot irons into the snow. I enter an old stone building, barely two rooms and a stable, wearing a moss jacket. A spider had taken refuge amongst the erosion of decay. It was calm inside, serene, the scornful wind scurrying, unable to come in and stray. An angry whistle taunted, but the spider and I obeyed. My mind wandered in the moment, taking a walk amongst strangers. They dance with me around memories, cuts, bruises, aches and pains. A stillborn child remains. Still, I think I'll stay here a while, if the ghosts don't mind. My host still bathing in the ether. The snow will stop soon, as will my thoughts, and my world will be healed once again. End poem.
Great read, Dex. Really well done. Laurent, would you want to kick us off?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Great. Excellently titled, Time to Stop and Think. As this poor mortal, as Mark says, walked in his path, taking the pine cones, spaghetti hair all knotted, which is a great description, looked into the sky, the blurred sky, that cries soft like confetti. Again, great phrasing sets the stage for us. A winter walk, perhaps early winter, perhaps late winter, flickers of green grass, grass, butter, peering above the crusted sheet. The stone building is a wonderful image. The stone is solid. It's going to be there a while. Two rooms in a stable, wearing a moss jacket. And then, of course, we discover the spider who had taken refuge as well. We get a sense, as he says, my mind wandered a moment, taking a walk amongst strangers presumably being ghosts, memories, his past. And he walked with those ghosts, yet he's going to stay where he is for a little while because there is perhaps silence, there is perhaps a certain peace there. and the snow will stop soon, as well my thoughts. And one assumes that when he stops thinking about the ghosts that don't mind, and his hosts bathing in the ether, that his world will indeed be healed once again. It's a very, very nice nice moment where we find time to stop and think and ruminate.
Nice comment, Laura. And Thomas, how about you?
This is one of those pieces where you sense the feeling of dread, the feeling of not care so much, but of turmoil. And and that self-consciousness that comes with that feeling of dread and turmoil, I'm sure I can hear them laughing. Look at that poor mortal kicking the pine cone, spaghetti hair all knotted. And his turmoil fringes on self-pity, but never quite gets there. And you feel as if he is trying to find some place to hide, some place to regroup and recommit to living and all that it brings. I mean, I love that. My mind wandered in the moment, taking a walk among strangers. They danced with me around memories, cuts, bruises, aches, and pains. A stillborn child remains. It's questionable whether the stillborn child is actual, and a lot of this is about the loss, or if all these thoughts have no, in comments from all these people, have no direction, have no purpose. I like the question that remains there about exactly what is going on. And then, as Laurent said nicely, and I'm sure others will, you know, you get this feeling that he's going to stay there until he comes to a place of peace, a place of direction, perhaps a place of death. But hopefully there is a positive note in the, and my mind will be, and my world will be healed once again, is a note of return and not of RIP. Really nicely done, and really, because of the questions that lie within this, you're really forced to stop and think about everything that he's saying. We'll put together.
Nice. Good comment, Tom. And Dex, how about you?
Yeah, this had the feel of visiting a mausoleum or something along those lines. You know, that's just what I thought, think of when I see the old stone building, and he was describing it almost covered in moss, or like, you know, and the spiders and the erosive and the decay. You know, some of the times those old mausoleums and some of those cemeteries just aren't the best kept. And sometimes it's just, you know, it just feels like, you know, you have all of these spirits and stuff dancing around. Now, I don't know if they possibly had a stillborn child and the stillborn was buried there, or, you know, it could be taken a few different directions, but that's just the kind of the feel that I had of this one, is just kind of taking a walk through a graveyard and possibly to some type of stone building along those lines. But very well done.
Nice comment. And Rex, how about you?
For me, it's a long, purposeful march, a sojourn to that which is to be. The note to the coral ghost swirl in the wind gives rise to death. He's sure they're mocking him with a laugh. The spaghetti hair all knotted, that means he's been out in this wilderness, so to speak, for a while, almost hermit-like. The crying soft white confetti snowflakes sink into my face. That's a nice touch to purity in the moment. He feels cold, but he's happy. And offering up, could there really be such an illusion, the beauty in this moment. Then a notation green grass flutter with the crusted sheet, and the robin pecks at the seed head. And I like the thought with the his little claw feet penetrate like hot irons into the snow. That gives rise to a pain, hot irons, that which burns within the body itself. Now, the old stone building, it's amongst the erosion of decay. It has a nice touch of that which might once have been home. The thought with the strain, dancing with the strangers, and the memories, cuts, bruises, aches, and pains. There's a notation to growth and being in that arena for many, many years. A stillborn child remains. That is, that hits that tone of losing a child. And still, it hits on that thought of he's been on this, because of that spaghetti hair, he's been on this long, lonely trek, sadness deep, and yet he seems to have come home at stone building representing what once was. And the bottom end, the last six lines, still I think I'll stay here a while if the ghosts don't mind. My host's still bathing in the ether. The snow will stop soon, as will my thoughts. There's a notation to death there, and my world will be healed once again. Now that single line by itself offers up the crossing over, the healed once again, reunited with that the stillborn child and the family he once knew that no longer occupies, except for maybe the ghosts that he does not recognize.
Nice. Big comment, Rex. Great job. And Pam, how about you?
Well, I have to say, I was just pleased as punch to see Mark Green write for the contest in the show. He's definitely one of my favorite poets on All Poetry. I like how he sets the tone and the atmosphere with his imagery, how the stone building itself, the moss and the spiders and the decay, all become almost like characters in the story. And I like how the stillborn child can be taken literally or metaphorically, and how this is a story about going back to visit those memories that hurt and finding that room to heal. So just an excellent write and very well done.
Okay. Just to let you know, Pam, Dex has dropped. I'm not sure if he's calling back. So
I appreciate the time he was able to give to us and for him calling in. So thank you very much, Dexter, and we'll catch you later sometime. All right, so I'll go ahead and I will get the next poem up. And up next we have With Shutters Drawn by Errant Panther. And Rex, will you give that a read for us, please?
Sure. With Shutters Drawn by Errant Panther. With shutters drawn, there can be no outward distraction, no gaze to sacrifice such countenance. There is only her before my eyes, and that will be everything required to sustain me. Stroke begets stroke, drawing brush to easel, sharpening tones upon supple shoulders, softening the edges of lips, pensively waiting for the moment this portrait is complete, so that she may rescind said pose, until many weeks have passed without their toils. With shutters drawn, her beauty, her presence consumed, as did this intense devotion to capture upon canvas, and yet, as the romance of her image grew ever more real as the candlelight streaming across the floor, the subject herself did wither and is no more. End poem.
Great read there, Rex, and just an awesome write by Errant Panther. I'm really glad that he was inspired. And Tom, let's start with your thoughts.
This is one of those pieces that builds really nicely in a slow, almost methodical without being so obvious, but in a way that, you know, you find yourself nodding in agreement, and before you know it, you're just in the poem and getting taken along by the current of its thinking and streams of its thought, pensively waiting for the moment this portrait is complete so that she may resend, say, said pose, until many weeks had passed without other toils. I just love lines like that, with shutters drawn, her beauty, her presence consumed, as did this intense devotion to capture it upon the canvas. I can hear the overtones of Oscar Wilde's, perhaps, Dorian Gray, but it also has a nice sort of evil sense of someone stealing away someone else's life onto their own canvas. So there's sort of a Pygmalion goalies type of horror here that I just find rather fascinating. And I mean, that opening, no gaze to sacrifice with such countenance, there is only her before my eyes. It's just very, it just captures a whole lot of different little angles of horror and does it in a nice subtle fashion, so that it isn't until you're at the very end and suddenly the effect of the whole thing falls upon you that you really realize how beautifully it's been done. Great piece. Well done, Aaron.
Absolutely, and great observation on the Pygmalion, observation that you made. Very cool there. I like that. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, this piece, I found it kind of bedeviling and fascinating at the same time. It was a painting in progress. The subject, bewitching and beautifully described in the first stanza, as has been quoted, and then towards the end, her beauty, her presence consumed, as did this intense devotion to capture it upon canvas. And then as we progress to the end, we realize that the subject has more or less disappeared in thin air, and you ask yourself, is she a figment of the mind's eye, in the painter's eye? Was she something they constructed simply to be there, or was there some kind of a diminution of the physical self? And then, of course, we enter the realm of the of almost dreamlike quality, the disturbing idea that as he painted, she withered, and he used it all up, at painting her so beautifully, almost incantatory in certain ways. Just with the gentle flow of the language. I mean, the subject herself did wither and is no more. I mean, it's her end. She's dead. She's gone. But he says it in such a, not casual way, but such a matter-of-fact and gentle, almost admiring way, that it the contrast between what you read and the tone is very, very interesting. I thought it was a fantastic piece.
Absolutely. Well said there. And Rex, your thoughts?
All right. The shutters drawn. I like that for the representation it gives. It isn't about drawing down the shutters. No painter, no artist would do that because they need that light. The shutters drawn here, for me, represent closing one's eyes in the moment and seeing that which she wants to paint. She is something that he has seen. He has noticed, he's taken in every detail with his eyes and his mind, and he's got it perfectly outlined within his head down to the last details. There's an obsession in here that bespeaks to the fact that he needs to put this portrait of this particular woman down on canvas. Stroke begets stroke, drawing brush to easel, sharpening tones upon supple shoulders. I guess note to that. I can see what's in my mind's eye. I know what's there. I know every drawn little edge. I know every little soft curve around the lips. I know the smile. I know the brightness in the eyes. And he hits on that again with the third stanza, with shutters drawn. Again, that note, closing one's eyes and seeing that picture-perfect moment of who she is, her beauty, her presence consumed. That's him as did this intense devotion to capture it on canvas. There is that heavy note to obsession of putting out the best possibility of who and what she is, even though he might not know her, and the romance of her image grew ever more real as the candlelight streaming across the floor. So he's working late into the night, trying to get every detail put down, until the subject herself did wither and is no more. That hits on the note of once that viewpoint in his head is put clearly on canvas and he's got everything down to that perfect note of who and what she is, that image he can let go of because now he has the physicality of that image in front of him.
Absolutely. Well said there. Great observation. Oh, absolutely, yes.
No, I just wanted to tip my hat to Rex for an evening of comments that are nothing short of breathtaking in many ways. I love to listen to your comments, Rex.
Thank you, Laurent.
Yes, I have to agree that I'm very glad that Rex called into the show tonight. Thank you. And, I really like how this becomes kind of the interaction between the creator and the creation. And I really like the lines, with shutters drawn, her beauty, her presence consumed, as did this intense devotion to capture it upon canvas. I like how this captures such a sense of obsession. So just an excellent write all the way through and very well done. All right. And I was going to put that poem up next, Gene. Look at you all stepping on my toes. I think you've given me a hint. All right. Well, I have been assigned to read this long poem because apparently I'm being punished for a crime I committed. I'm not quite sure, but anyways, I'm happy to do this, actually. This is The Curse. Oh, sorry. Did you say something, Jean? Okay, I guess not. Okay. You know, I think what it is, I think I have an echo. And so when I hear the echo of my voice, I think it's Jean, but all right. So this is Curse of the Raven by Mr. M, and it goes like this. In these halls my father stood, his tacit temple of earth and wood, often delving into the mysteries of long-forgotten lore. He wrote obsessively of a bird who muttered, repeated a single word, but for years his claims had gone unheard about the demon who perched above his chamber door, the ebon fiendish aberration who frightened him to his core, whom the hells had dubbed as Nevermore. Surely he had no way of knowing of the child that at distance growing was a product of seeds he'd been sowing amidst the days he would explore, a time when he was not secluded, his darkness not as deeply rooted, nor was his mind as warped, convoluted as the fate that was in store. For merely a shadow of my father was I able to adore. Few of my longing evermore. How I wish my father had known he had a daughter to call his own. Then maybe he wouldn't have felt as alone after the loss of his beloved Lenore. Writhing in his ceaseless sorrow, often a heart he'd wish to borrow, but darkness had met him on the morrow just as faithfully as the days before. Seemingly he was a slave to the misery he bore, merely a shell and nothing more. So I've come to this dreary place to find an inkling or a trace of what sped his agony's destructive pace, wounding a heart that grief had tore. What malevolence could instill to break the broken further still. Taking the remnants of a shattered will and tossing it to the nightly shore, tearing further the wounded heart he wore, all to the echoes of nevermore. In this vast and elaborate room is where the madness would consume, binding father to his wretched gloom, till the dirge of prudence hummed its final score. Below the bust that is now broken, there lay an ominous ebon token, perhaps of the fabled creature spoken in the ramblings of my father's lore, the tortured musings of his tragic inner war that left him altered evermore. With the grasping of the feather, great evil seemed to tether, invoking whispers from the nether that had soon begun to roar. Merely a singular blackened plume emanating a hellish fume seemed to summon the herald of doom that had defiled these walls before, the infernal abomination that sat above the door, spewing its credence of nevermore. But with confidence now shaken, fear began to swiftly awaken, wondering if I were mistaken in rapping on hell's audacious door. The ebony clock let loose a toll that shook me to my very soul. Then the feather turned as hot as coal and fell upon the dusty floor. Just what grim, ghastly perversions are there in store, heightening curiosity even more. But as I sat engaged in guessing, with fear and wonder coalescing, I could not help in expressing the inquiries held at my core. What of the fiendish raven who took this home as newfound haven, with image so aptly graven in tandem with that of Lenore, the creature which forsook the memories of Lenore, defiling them forevermore? Yet my echoes wandered about, beginning to fill me with some doubt, and just as I was about to shout, the clock began again tolled much louder than before. Then the door had flung agape, dislodging every silken drape, and the shadows took the haunting shape of the fiend that I abhor, the one being for which my hatred does outpour, that flaunts its name as nevermore. In the raven lawfully flew, as the wind and rain savagely blew, in this wicked storm that seemed to brew, it only the merest of moments before, he made his perch upon the chair, as if somehow he belonged there, nonchalantly preening without a care, nursing the beguiling visage he wore, carelessly tending to the mocking disguise it wore, fueling my contempt even more. You traverse the twisted nether with evil ingrained in every feather, not even lending a care whether someone stood here as you glided o'er. Detestable demon from the abyss where the hearts of angels have gone remiss, still your pride, and answer me this. What hast thou tainted the sacred Lenore, the angel who caused my father's heart to soar? But only silence and nothing more. Damnable wretch, I exclaim, with your hubris and pride inflamed, the fiend who is so aptly named as the infamous Nevermore. But as I spoke its cursed name, its eyes seemed to spark a flame. It flapped its wings, and then came a terrifying and violent roar, sealing shut the enormous mahogany door, then just stared and nothing more. A smell of sulfur filled the air. Its eyes continued to fervently flare. I was then overcome by a despair that I had never felt before. The temperature rose by many degrees, bringing me back panting to my knees. As I felt their saying, please, I saw a shadow upon the floor cast from the eyes that burned as molten core, that frightened me to my very core. It was then I knew the fiendish devil that lawfully flew, which tore plumes of darkest hue, was the man I grew to adore. My father's soul was to dwell in this harbinger's corrupted shell, till the ebon clock's final knell could free him from the pain he bore, the foul, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous mask he wore that now will bind him nevermore. So now this wicked, malevolent bane, a thousand lifetimes worth of pain, damning me to spiteful remain, with these days become that of yore, burdened with a baleful dread, the scorn and resentment of many dead. Their sins are cast upon my head, just as was said in Father's lore. Now a vile specter damned to walk the nightly shore, I am doomed to wander forevermore. End poem. Oh, wow, I have to say, that one is just really cool. I like the twist that he took on this, with it being the daughter of Edgar Allan Poe, or the character in the original poem, The Raven. It's absolutely just epic. It's good to see Mr. M and his dark rights. This was just very well done. And thank you, everyone, for listening to that long read. But I think it was definitely worth it because it was beautiful. And Rex, your thoughts?
Hit on that. The notion with the thought to the daughter that he bore but never saw was a nice intonation. In that thought, you can coalesce the idea of both the demise of Lenore and Poe himself, and offer up those long-forgotten notes and the tragedy therein, because she never got to be part of either's life. And there's a great role to this. The opening and first few stanzas hitting on that thought of the father and his descent into madness and her pain in understanding that, but not knowing the reality behind that which took him. And then she hits on that notion of she being in that moment of fear and dread, which once encompassed her father, and now she's questioning and trying to understand even more. But as she is doing that, she's also giving open to the possibility that with the raven coming in to the scene at that moment, somewhere around midnight would be my guess, that it is calling once more for something more of a soul. It needs another, wants to pass over onto another body. So that one has played out its part, while the new one, new angle, being the daughter, will take over the mantle, so to speak, of the nevermore.
Absolutely. Wonderful observations, as always, Rex. Thank you very much. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, just to get this straight, I'm supposed to thank you for letting me go after Rex.
Not only are you supposed to thank me, you're supposed to kick my feet while you do it.
All right, where I know where I am. I commented on this. You know what? I think he just made me lose my whole comment because I hadn't saved it yet. I could have sworn I did, and it was lengthy. Damn it! All right, let me see what I can do here. What I liked about this was that it was an exceptionally good pastiche or parody of the original. The source is unimpeachable. And he's thrown in such a clever twist, male to female, towards the end. The use of language, well, he's well known for his verbal stylings. There's very little that he touches that doesn't come off beautifully. But, you know, when you're face-to-face with an epic poem like this, sometimes there are no words of eloquence that you feel inside of you or in any way going to be able to transmit the feeling on gave you. And it's kind of like that with this poem. It leaves me wanting to be silent, appreciating what I've just read, appreciating the visions that dance in my head, spurred on by the language, and you just want to sit there and enjoy the moment. And so I will.
I'm going to assume there aren't visions of sugar plums dancing in your head right now.
No, I just taking away to punish you.
Great comment there, Lawrence. And Jean, your thoughts?
You know, I'm not quite sure how I did not comment on this piece before, because I remember being kind of blown away by the work itself. So I actually got a chance to write a comment. And I said, you know, it was a perfect sister write to the original by Poe himself, because they think they did go hand in hand in a lot of ways, because the character in this was the daughter of the character in The Raven. And I think that he really did an exceptional job. Sorry?
Oh, I think somebody was just clearing their throat or something.
That was me. I didn't realize I echoed back to myself. But I think that Robert really upped his game when it came to penning this. It was an amazing job, and I love how he wrote it from the female perspective. I don't know how long it actually took him to write it, but he just made it seem easy, you know, because the write read easily. And Pam, the only reason you got to read it, because I would have just been starting over. This would have taken 15 minutes for me. See, and we didn't need two 15-minute reads in one show, because I would have kept stopping and starting again. But it was definitely a beautiful beautiful piece to go with Poe. And he said he wasn't sure if it was quite on topic. But I remembered the piece and asked him for it specifically because I felt that it was a great reflection of Poe. So
absolutely.
Anyway,
and I am glad it got shared tonight. And you're right there, Jean. It is beautiful, and I'm glad it got shared tonight. And when I hit the line about knowing that he had a daughter, I was like, okay, now this explains why we didn't have Rex read this.
Yeah, because that was why he asked for a female voice, because it was written from a female perspective. So that's why
that
he actually, but yeah, Robert had requested that specifically, that a female read it. And he says, you know, Pam or yourself. And I'm like, oh, out of my league. You know, I can read something, you know, mid-sized, but I think I would have just tripped all over this eventually, because my tongue would have gotten tired. Like that happened. Anyway.
Well, I understand that.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and have us move on to the next write, which is Pariah House by Eric Svensson. And we have a SoundCloud for that. So whenever you're ready, Gene.
Here we go.
Pariah House. Frown, skull of Victorian mansion. Stolbrand's memory bank. Overbearing silence to this day for birds. When questions were asked, adult tongues disappeared, lips sealed, bank vault tight, heads turned left to right in decisive no. Animated, some folks made the sign of the cross. Vague, opaque, like a sepia painting, silence stained a two-story enigma. Eight oak trees surrounded the mansion. Hence, town folks refer to the paramour as Eight Oaks. By the time my father acquired this contemptible property, the eight oak trees were maligned. Neglect, town gossip, hatred. Who can tell? The mansion was imported piece by piece from England. Corrugated iron roof, cast iron bricky lace railings for the surrounding verandas, vast black sash windows, carved sandstone blocks, still shiver as I battle to describe father's investment. Why would a farmer buy such a house of Asher? Townsfolk scoffed, turned their heads away when they walked by. First visit, and only visit, took place on a bitter cold winter's day. Bitter bite of ferocious hounds of Baskerville frost snapped at my youthful ankles. The humongous front door towered over me. Solid, albeit motley, black paint peel. All of my 9 years held its breath. Entrance hall staircase swept towards infinity. Born gleam mahogany chipped like long nails had angrily scratched with each step that was taken upwards. Sensitive of nature, my two older brothers jeered, jabbed me in the side. Must be rot or decay. I seemed to be the only one to notice. A sticky, salty smell crept up into my nostrils. Huge rooms with no end, ornate fireplace in each room. Yet August hyena winds outside mocked imported Victorian fancy. Still wake up some nights in sweat, never told father, mother, or my two other siblings. That thing that slobbered saliva in the third bedroom upstairs, it still makes its presence known. What does a 9-year-old know about psychic paranormal activity? What's the matter with you? Why are you shivering like that? Couldn't my father see her? She hung in a crushed red velvet dress, rope tied around her neck above the fireplace. Her tongue wasn't quiet. Her lips weren't sealed tight like a bank vault. Her eyes pleaded. Bloated tongue struggled to sing, "Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's going to buy you a mockingbird." Years later, it became clear to me. My father tried his damnest to persuade the town council to make money available. Restoration, preservation for later generations. Their lips remained sealed. Tongues disappeared. Horror of horrors. Boer versus Brit politics of those years. Not that my granddad was either. He was Danish. What would Poe say about this pariah house? In the end, the Boer town council broke it down, sandstone by sandstone. End Poe.
Great read, Eric. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. Oh, my goodness. This is such a dark write. And then it's even A.N. He puts in it's an autobiographical poem, which really makes shivers go up and down my spine. That is wow. Okay, so Lauren, now is the time where you thank me for allowing you to comment before Rex.
I'm not ready. No, I'm just kidding. this is a formidable work, really. He's recreated the House of Usher with a fascinating backstory. The adult's tongue, adult tongues disappeared, lips sealed, bank vault tight, heads turned left to right in decisive no, animated some folks, made the sign of the cross, all in response to questions asked. And his description of the house is nonpareil. The business of his father acquiring the property, and it's called a contemptible property. Eight oak trees were maligned. Neglect, town gossip, hatred. Who can tell? And then to have it imported from England. Now, I don't know whether they went to Boer South Africa or Boer Dutch. Either way, it was reborn at something that nobody liked. His language is first rate. First visit and only visit took place on a bitter cold winter's day. Bitter bite of ferocious hounds of Baskerville frost snapped at my youthful ankles. He paints such a picture of that young boy. All my 9 years held a threat with his wonderful phrasing. And the cheering of his two older brothers made this whole thing seem very, very alive. The sticky, salty smell which crept up into his nostrils is exactly the smell of death. I thought he hit that perfectly. Must be rot or decay. He sensed something, but then to have him experience the psychic paranormal in the form of a young girl hung, her tongue protruding, eyes pleading, just, yeah. It was disturbing, but not disturbing in a bad way. You have to appreciate that kind of disturbing that paints so horrific a picture, but one that you can appreciate at the same time. It does a wonderful job with this particular piece. The resolution of having it broken down sandstone by sandstone may speak to its evil, perceived evil. You want to demolish it completely and have no sense of anything remaining of this horror. Bravo, Eric.
Absolutely. And that's a wonderful comment. I agree. He does paint a picture, and not just with the imagery, but the way he describes, like you said, the smell of death. So excellent observations. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, the house is gorgeous. Typical from, I guess, mid to late 1800s, and to have it shipped over piece by piece from England to South Africa is not a cheap venture to begin with. So whoever brought it over in the first place meant it to last a lifetime. And yes, it had a stark and disturbingly a point of view from the townsfolk. Their lips sealed, bank vault tight, heads turned left, right, and decisive no. Animated, some folks made the sign of the cross. They would not offer up that which the history behind the place there, and why it stands still, why it's so desolate, why it looks the way it does, just that animated, haunted wreck on the outside of town, so to speak. And then that second stanza hits on the thought of sepia painting, which is a perfect thought for the yellowed, aged appearance of the place to begin with. And I like the descriptive quality through and the corrugated iron roof, the cast iron Brookie Lake railings, the brass dashed windows, the carved sandstone blocks. And so there's that notation, and it runs it through the thoughts of a boy at the time, a 9-year-old, still shiver as I battle to describe father's investment. Why would a farmer buy such a house of Russia? House folks stopped, turned their heads away when they walked by. So even afterwards, with new owners and maybe adjusting up the house a bit from its previous unkempt condition, and still it was not good enough. Something walks ugly. And then he throws in the house of Baskerville, the notation there, cleverly drawn. And then born green mahogany, like non-male, had a gangly scratch with each step taken upwards. It kind of hits on the note of maybe the kids running through the house on a ghostly entreat as it stood empty. And then the rot, the decay, you kind of get that sticky, salty smoke up that into his nostrils. There's a notation of being a little aware of the kiddie fantasy in the moment, nine years old, and you look at this front door, and it's massive. It stands head and tails above you. And I like the thought, the August hyena winds above the that third bedroom, the woman in a red velvet dress, and she offers up a little thought to blow the tongue, struggle to sing, hush little baby, don't say a word. Obviously, I'm a mockingbird. It gets a eerie note of, well, nobody else is going to know what is there or see what is there, because as a child, you still have that little vague illusion in believing that which is that veil from one side to the next. It's still open. It's got, you've got that aired view. You haven't been crossed over into adulthood where you don't believe in ghosts, you don't believe in fairy tales, you don't believe in Santa Claus and all that stuff. So that still has that nice ringing note to it as well. But I don't like that. The ending is sad in itself. It is, in the end, the board town council broke it down, sandstone by sandstone. It fits the House of Usher motif, but it's sad to see something that beautiful rendered asunder, because you know what? They weren't going to save a damn bit of it to use for something else. They were just going to destroy it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great observations there, Rex, and well said. Yeah, I really like how he delves into the history of the place and how there's that undertone of hate and prejudice and, you know, secrets that people don't want let out. Just really thought that was amazing. And I'm going to go ahead and have us move on to the last rite for the night, a shorter one, Acuteness of the Senses by Aphasiana. And Jean, would you give that a read for us, please? Maybe? Yes, no? She's hiding. Okay, I guess she can't.
Oh. No. I had my cell phone looking for the poem before I did that. Okay, so here we go. This is Acuteness of the Senses by Aphasiana. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is an over-acuteness of the senses? Ho, the telltale heart. Skeptical of my overactive senses, you assume superstitious pretenses. Telepathy is merely observed variances in tone, expression, complexion, and pulses. Accidental eavesdropping with heightened hearing, responding to what they don't understand fearing. Voices are not in my head, I assure you. Real noise was why I hastily withdrew. Incredible how damaged tissue increased perception you'd expect the least. Internal barometer and seismograph are concepts that make the ignorant laugh. Yet I'm not mad to feel what approaches, even if on my peace it often encroaches. And the poem.
Great read there, Jean. Thank you very much. A wonderful write of Aphasiana. I really like how she took that quote from The Telltale Heart and wove her own life, her own experience with the brain surgery and the, you know, damage, and gave us really raw, honest information about what she goes through, about what it's like to deal with acuteness of the senses and people not understanding. And I know we don't have a lot of time left, but I do want to get some comments for her. So, Rex, your thoughts on Aphasiana's poem.
Perception is that which one holds in the sense of themselves, and that which they can't explain, they often push off as that you're imagining or you're lying. But the idea is when the brain gets damaged a little bit, it often opens up other avenues to help compensate for that which was damaged in the first place. And that could be heightened perception, heightened awareness, heightened hearing, or information to aromas, all manner of things. And it could be a little dropping into that behind that veil of a world that nobody else knows about except those who can actually hear something or see something from that angle.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well said there. And Warrant, your thoughts.
This poem really works very well as the madness quoted in the quotation from the Telltale Heart as the analog for the overactive senses, where people may assume superstitious pretenses, perhaps including telepathy. But, you know, there's so many things that account for that happening, and she goes over them. And really does a great job in the last stanza of looking at the whole aspect of damaged tissue in the brain and what, because the brain, I think, is far deeper than we know. I don't think we've scratched the surface with it yet. And when we do, it's going to be absolutely amazing. But she deals with it. Yet I'm not mad to feel it approaches, even if on my peace it often encroaches. You know, face your enemy. Face the issue. Face the problem. Deal with it that way. It's much better. And it's right. So.
Absolutely. Well said. And thank you, Afaviana, for writing for the show. I really appreciate that. I'm glad you were inspired. I'd like to say thank you to Jean, as always, for everything she does in the background and for being an awesome co-host. Thank you again to Rex for making that recording for the beginning of the show. Thank you to Lawrence, Tom, Dexter, Rex, and Dimitri for calling in. Thank you to Aaron's Panther, Frank, Poetic Picasso, and Sapphire Rose for hanging on the board. Thank you to everyone who wrote for the show, who is listening now or will be listening later. We truly appreciate you all. And join us in about 25 minutes, 12:30 a.m. Eastern U.S. time, for the late nights with the Midnight Bomber and Captain B2 with poetry inspired by some just really amazing dark artwork. And Jean, anything you'd like to say?
Just thank you to everyone who called in and held down the board and you know, great topic. Pam, really great writes that came in tonight. And then we have some carryovers for you, I guess, for your dark show if you need them. And if not, we'll figure it out.
There you go. I think they'll work later. Yep, exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. Sounds like a good plan to me.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Rex, for calling. And thank you, Laurent, for hanging out with us all night and keeping us out of trouble. What we do. I mean,
thank you.
We're troublemakers in your family. And Rex ain't too bad. And neither are you, Laurent. Great quartet. Thanks, guys. Have a great night.
Night, gang.
Right on.
Thank you.